Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is the Booker T. Washington Speaks program, your Saturday night live, educational, and hopefully informative and entertaining program and discussion forum, where we will be discussing many, many various items that pertain to the life of the African-American community. At this time, I would like to turn the mic over to my co-host, Mr. Ali Mustafa. Mr. Mustafa, are you online? You have the mic.
Yes, good evening, everyone. Again, welcome to this week's Booker T. Washington Speaks. By now, we as Americans from all walks of life are fully engulfed in the 2017 New Year spirit. Certainly, after celebrating the festivities with the greetings of Happy New Year, it's really time to come back to reality as African Americans suffering from a lack of wealth and opportunities to compete fairly in the local and global economic pursuit of happiness. Before I begin, I'd like to say a prayer asking Almighty God, our universal creator, to bless and protect us as we journey on to our individual and collective missions for prosperity and social change that was defined by Dr. Booker T. Washington, so that the graduates from Tuskegee Normal Institute would have a clearly defined goal to push forward to define their mission of the Institute. From dust to industry was a goal to be accomplished by the wave of graduating classes. Before continuing, I want to formally begin with the with this prayer. With the name of Almighty God, Allah, most gracious, most merciful, thy guidance and thy aid we seek daily. Show us a straight way, the way that leads to your mercy, forgiveness, and continued direction. Praise be to our Creator. It is we, the believers in America, who came from our enslaved African ancestors, who became the slave laborer and economic fodder for over 400 years, which is now a new system for modern-day slavery. Almighty Creator, we as your dutiful servants in America and around the world do humbly seek and sincerely pray for your hand of protection and your insightful guidance will take our people to the next spiritual level in our struggles to understand this life and what it is that you truly demand of all of us, despite our cultural heritage or skin color. At this moment in today's program, thank you very much. At this moment in today's program, I'd like to introduce the book's author, who is a senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder and director of Tuskegee Normal. He is truly a gifted and insightful author. So I want to inform you to get ready for a dynamic experience that will change your life forever as you read the pages of the book publication, which is called Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. This book is sure to be a number one bestseller domestically and globally. Let's get ready for our brother, Marshall Washington Cavendish Ogbui. He, without further delay, all of us here at Booker T. Washington Speaks present our brother. We love him so much. And here he is.
Good evening, and again, welcome to Booker T. Washington Speaks, our weekly forum in which we hope to develop an ongoing discussion on a wide range of topics that pertain to the African-American community in its many, many different facets. One of the major topics which we began discussing last week was the question, how can we improve African-American education? I see on our dashboard that we have a number of educators that are actually ready to speak, or perhaps not, but you have the mic. And so what we're going to do is we're going to just go ahead and open up with a few comments and let the audience, as you will, just come online. And I was initially going to bring you on and invite you to speak by turns, but I think we'll do it a little differently. I think it'll be fine. We're all professionals, and we've attended many meetings, some online, some in the offices, in conference rooms, classrooms, etc. So I think we can just regulate ourselves rather than have the moderator, myself, regulate the input. So what we'll do in this format is when a person is speaking, let that person finish saying whatever they desire to say, and then when there's an end to that, then the next person who wants to speak can just go ahead and begin your commentary. And if you want to ask a question of myself or of the co-host, just go ahead and ask your question. I'll go ahead and do whatever I can in the way of giving you a good answer, and I'm sure the co-host will do the same. So I'm going to ask my co-host to come back online. There were some things that I knew, or there are some things that I knew he wanted to address, and then when you're finished, the next person who would like to make a comment can respond to your comment or make a comment related to the topic of their own. So, Halim Mustafa, yeah, would you go ahead and go ahead and take it from here?
Yes. I had a very wise lady named Dr. Fatima Ali. She was one who was teaching me about dyslexia as a gift. And what she told me that she actually was working with this gentleman who was a bomb maker for the government. And so she was trying to really learn how to focus his mind. And so she was sharing with me that what she was teaching him. And she told me that the process that she used was to get his ears and his eyes to center point his mind in the middle of his head. Like, I guess if you would look at, say, the pineal gland in the third eye, to make all that focus come straight forward. And with this, she said she was able to get him to get more focus and more clarity in what he was trying to learn how to do to get his control of his dyslexia, which some people thought it was like something that was bad, but she said dyslexia is a gift. And so that's one thing in terms of education that some of us don't understand, that a lot of young people have dyslexia. And we have to not put them in a corner and shut them up, but, you know, teach them how to control that gift. And she showed me how to use that, and certainly with the pineal gland that she was talking about, using the eyes, the ears, and the mind to focus in the center of the forehead and project it forward. So that, I just want to share that. Dr. Fatima Ali was a lady that taught me this process.
Thank you very much, Ali Mustafa, our co-host, for that very insightful experience that you had. And I did know Dr. Fatima Ali, but not as well as you did. And I do know that she was a brilliant teacher, a brilliant psychologist, and I've heard many wonderful things about her. For the audience members that are not familiar with the person that we are discussing, her name was originally Dr. Ann Redmond. Of course, originally she didn't have the doctorate, but when I first met her, she was Dr. Ann Redmond around 1973, I believe it was. And she began working with the Nation of Islam under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and later transitioned to working with his son, Imam Wallace D. Muhammad, as an educator for the Muslim school system. but she had quite an expansive and extensive background in the university educational system prior to taking on that role. We want to open up the discussion now. Would anyone else that knew Dr. Ali like to make a comment at this time? Well, that's something we'll probably come back to, is that particular topic of dyslexia. I'll just mention that I'm an educator myself, having completed the coursework and the comprehensive examinations for a PhD in education in the field, specifically of adult and post-secondary education, and I'm still working to complete the research for the dissertation. But at one point, I was very interested in studying dyslexia and developed a model to help students deal with dyslexia by using a different type of color paging, transparent, not really transparent, but translucent color paging to help students to be able to see in a different perspective and to help them to organize their sight patterns, to basically adjust their sight patterns to become more able to read. I haven't further worked on that project, but there are many things going on now in the educational field to help students that have different types of what some people call challenges, but really there are opportunities because everyone is different. And unfortunately, the American and European models of education like to put everyone, cast everyone in the same mold. I would like to pick up this discussion on the topic of what is the mold of American education, so that we can begin to address the topic of what can we do to improve African-American education. And African-American education needs very special attention because an abnormal amount, and I say abnormal in relationship to the majority culture, of our students are failing to meet the standards in the public schools. And many of these students are not graduating, which is causing them to miss out on many opportunities that others have that have high school diplomas. And particularly, many of our students are not able to get into good colleges, or they're being, in a sense, exploited by colleges that are not selective, particularly for-profit programs that are not very selective, and they're not actually prepared for the fast pace of some of these schools, and they drop out owing lots of money to the schools or to the federal government. We want to pick up another thought on this. Would anyone else like to address the topic of why our students are failing in school? Mr. Mustafa, are you there? Mr. Mustafa,
yes,
I'm here.
I'm here. Yes. I think that a lot of the failure certainly it comes from the preparation. Okay, at home there's a preparation that has to be done with, like, paying attention to the homework assignments that be given. Parents, like I have children at home, and I have to actually sit down with them and walk through what they're learning and talk to them, speak to them to make sure that they understand it. Now, some parents don't spend that kind of time, and the child doesn't do their homework. They just put it down because no one's interested in it. And so you have to show interest as a parent, and that gives motivation to that child to want to do the best they can, because they want to prove to their parents that, hey, I received the love that you're given. And so that makes them put a better effort in. That's number one. And then certainly the second is learning how to be organized in terms of having their homework not all crumpled up, you know, because that behavior starts settling in. And later when they get older, they'll have papers all balled up, and this is a homework assignment being turned in, and the teacher's not going to really look at that and take it seriously, right? So it begins at home, and then it's the idea of communicating with them to let them understand the importance of their homework assignments, because it reinforces what they, you know, the teacher's teaching and what they need to learn for the long end goal, whatever that might be. But, of course, the organization ability is going to be definitely necessary as they go to higher levels of education. And so that's my comments for now, but I certainly want to just throw that out as what is what I have experienced as a parent and also a motivational teacher as well.
But that's very, very true. And one of the things that I do, want to address was actually addressed 45 years ago by a professor named Charles Silverman. Dr. Silverman worked for a number of years in the African American educational setting and did an extensive study, which he published in a book in 1970, which was named Crisis in the Classroom. And as I reviewed this book, I began to understand that the same problems that existed at that time still exist today in 2017. One of the major things that he found in his work was that the purpose of the system, the educational system, was not to help our students to become learners, but to help them become puppets. He didn't use that term, but I'm using that term. He actually did address that theme, and he called the topic of his chapter in his book, What is Wrong with Education, and specifically, Education for Docility. And he quotes from a classic educator, John Amos Comenius, in a study or book written in 1632 called The Great Didactic. And this scholar, Comenius, said that teachers almost invariably take their pupils as they find them. They turn them, they beat them, they card them, they comb them, they drill them into certain forms and expect them to become a finished and polished product. And if the result does not come up to their expectations, they are indignant, angry, and furious. And yet we are surprised that some men shirk, or pardon me, shrink and recoil from such a system. We are surprised when some students shrink and recoil from such a system. But more is it a matter of surprise than anyone can endure it at all. And Dr. Silverman goes on to say that the essence of the student's objective in the school system is to survive, that the students are involuntarily required to do whatever it takes to be able to get out of the system as quickly as they can, because it is not designed to encourage them to grow as people, but just to become molded to fit into the needs of the system. And Dr. Silverman says the students are forced to develop a variety of adaptive strategies and attitudes and survival, getting through and compiling a good record or avoiding a bad record does become the goal. And then he goes on to say, and I'll turn it over to someone else in just a second, he says, unfortunately, survival has little to do with learning in the sense of cognitive development. For children, the central business of school is not learning. It is getting those daily tasks done, or at least out of the way, with a minimum of effort, with a minimum of effort and unpleasantness. So here we have a system that works against the grain of the student's natural desire to be expressive and to learn because of the natural curiosity about the world around him or her. but this natural curiosity is stifled by the requirement just to please the teacher, to conform, so that the teacher will, pardon me, so that the student will not have an unpleasant experience. Would anyone like to respond to that?
Good evening.
Go ahead, next person.
Being heard, okay? Sure. Am I being heard, okay?
I have someone I just put on the mic whose last four of the phone numbers 9724. I had you off the mic and I have you on now. Would you like to respond to that?
Yes, I still make it. Good evening, everybody. I just want to just say this, the Japanese people, when their children come into the classroom in the mornings, they don't force them to go sit down and pay attention to what the teacher wants to say to them at that time. And when they, you know, it's like when you come into your office in the morning, you know, as an adult, we socialize with each other, talk, have coffee, something to drink, relax, and so maybe talk about what we're going to do for the day with the students or whatever. But we don't allow our children that same option. Japanese, they do. When their children come in the classroom, they don't tell them to sit down. They wait until the children decide to sit down because they said that when they sit down, then they're ready to learn. And they automatically, after they talk and socialize with each other for a few moments or whatever, however long, then they eventually they take a seat and they're ready to learn. But we don't even allow our children that, but we do ourselves. You know, we come to school as educators and, you know, we say good morning to the other, our peers or whatever, and have coffee or something and talk a few minutes. But we don't allow our children that. We have them come to the classroom. We want them to take off their coats and sit down to each other, just a rigid act about that at all. And if they don't do that, I don't even know, was it always that in the education system here in America or what? I don't know. I think we need to change that, first of all. I think that's something that needs to be changed. I think we need to give the children the option to at least socialize with each other when they come into the classroom. That's all I have to say about that. Hello?
Hey, just a minute. I'm just trying to clear up. Someone has a mic on and that has some very distracting noise in the background. I think it's gone now. I would like to address what your question was. You were discussing the comparison between the Japanese system of giving the children, I'm using my own words, more freedom of expression and more individual identity in the classroom rather than letting the students come in and sit down and not have a chance to basically relax in that environment, whereas the faculty can go in the break room, they can adjust to the day by having a chat, maybe some. And you were saying that, or you were asking about the history, whether it's always been that domineering in American classrooms, and yes, it has, and I can say this from my study of American education without going into a disquisition about it. You know, first of all, public education, as we know it, did not begin until around the 1830s up in Massachusetts with Horace Mann, who was the superintendent of education for the Massachusetts school system, introducing the idea of expanding education so that all of the people, particularly the lower income stratum of the society, could have access to education. And, of course, this idea began to spread throughout the country. And, of course, the black people weren't able to participate because it was against the law up until after the Civil War to educate the slaves, and that included practically all of the black people in the South. There were a few exceptions, New Orleans and Mobile and Savannah. and Charleston were places where there were some free black people, but there was no school system set up for them except perhaps in private situations. But the thing about it is education, as we know it in America, does actually go back to the beginning of the nation, where the wealthy people hired private tutors to train their young people in the classics and language, arts, and also in sciences, to prepare them to become the masters of the community, the leaders in the civil society, as well as ministers. And these people were the ones that went into the colleges such as Harvard and Yale, Princeton, and other so-called Ivy League colleges. But the masses of the people were not trained to be leaders per se. They were trained to be docile followers. And so this idea of the students just being there to be trained to do what they were told and not to have any freedom of expression goes back to the beginning of this American educational system. Does that address your question at all?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for that. The whole system, I think, here in the United States has pretty much failed. I think that all the children are being miseducated. An education is supposed to be something that prepares you for a profession, and maybe at one time it did that, I don't know. When people graduated from high school, I think they were prepared to go into the workforce once they graduated. I don't know if our system is doing that anymore. You know, we're living in an information age now, so we don't really need, robotics is taking over, so we don't need people's manual labor too much. I don't really see where our children are being prepared to be productive citizens in society anymore. And I don't see that anymore. You know, when they graduate, they're not prepared. They're not ready to go out into the workforce. I think that's what did take place before, and now we have societies full of people with all kinds of degrees, and there are no jobs for them. And when they graduate from school, they have all these student loans that they have to pay back. They can't find a job, but they have to start paying those loans back right away. And I don't know what's going to happen. This society is just, I know people who have PhDs in law who are working in New York City, living out of their cars, using lockers every day to store their belongings in while they go to work, because although they have a job and they're making a certain amount of money, they still do not have enough income to provide for themselves. Or when I say, it's not only when they graduate high school. Today, when they graduate from doctorates, people have masters and doctors, and they can't find a job. So there's such an imbalance in our society on so many levels. I don't know what to say. I really have to think about it. I really have to think about this.
This is Haleem Mustafa with a comment. You're certainly right, correct, and you're giving a synopsis of that. I see it like right now they're dumbing down the talent. They're not preparing them to be competitive in the academic world here against in terms of other countries. And I think that's important, but it's a dumbing down that's going down. And so sit down and be stupid. Don't ask questions. And just listen to what I'm telling you. Don't use your own thinking, because you're not a teacher. That's what they're doing. They're conveying, shutting these young people out And even at the level of going to college, they're not giving them that freedom of speech, you know, to actually have a conversation without being a teacher being intimidated because the young person is asking questions. See, the teacher is supposed to be able to hear any question and be able to give a response that gives the kids the logic to analyze and start to doing their own self-analysis so they can start to take on the personal responsibility to learn, right? Because sometimes, you know, like going to school don't make you smart either, right? But the experience of learning, it can make you have the ability to be flexible and learn everywhere you go. You can observe and learn. You can watch birds and watch the process of how they interact. See, education is more than just what sitting down and doing A, B, C, D, E, F, G. That's my opinion about what I've observed and stuff. So anyway, that's a comment to what you were saying.
I'd just like to chip in and mention something, too, and that is the fact that in every society you have a power structure, and depending on the character of the power structure will be the resulting educational system or educational mission. Now, where you have an oligarchic power structure or a totalitarian autocratic power structure as the original foundation of America was, in fact, you had an oligarchic power structure. You had the rich planters that were the ones that determined who was going to learn what. And obviously they wanted to perpetuate their dynastic power. So it was their intention to only educate their children, and since at that time the society was based on male dominance, and thank God that's changed, because so much of the benefits of having equal partnership that could have existed in the primarily the first 150 years of American development was actually lost because the ladies were not invited to be equal participants in the governance of the communities or in the nation. But the fact is that these oligarchic masters, who I call the slave masters, whether they actually had physical slaves on their plantations or they just tried to make slaves out of the rest of their own people, which was a fact, that these people never intended initially to even have such a thing as public education. And when they finally were convinced that they should train the immigrants coming into the United States in the 19th century, in the beginning of the 19th century, they called it education. But it wasn't really education. It was simply indoctrination to be docile servants of these masters. So that's my comment on that for right now.
Yeah. Let me get... am I on? Am I in?
Yes.
You got the mic. Go ahead,
okay.
Please.
Okay. This is Amir Muhammad. I will go back to Brother Mustafa's early statement. And first of all, you asked, was there anybody that knew Dr. Ali? Well, you know that I did know Dr. Ali. 35, 40 years I worked with her. In fact, I tried to get away from her because I didn't want... She was such a heavy woman and so experienced. I was in my 30s. I think I was 30 years old. Doc was 52. And I just wanted to go back to Berkeley and go to law school, but she just was determined to take me to New York with her. And I did. I finally got talked into it. But Dr. Lee was a Scientologist. She did eventually leave it. Now, we were very close friends for 35, 40 years. She left Scientology and then started helping the guy, I can't think of his name now, that's why I didn't speak up right away, who started the dyslexic school. Actually, she set all of that up and the programming.
Brown, his name is Brown. His name is Ron Brown, Ron Brown.
Ron, yeah, that's right. I knew it was Ron. Now, Ron tricked her and his own wife because Alice left him. And he had been a Scientologist, so he used Doc, and she realized it, to get that dyslexic program going. One of the things she said about dyslexia is that the dyslexic child is disoriented. And that disorientation led me to tell her about 20 years later, because I was there. I always went to the office without. I may have gone out to see her all 3 to 5 times a year after we left New York. She left in New York and went to Chicago to get over the whole school, the whole Muslim schools all over America, and left me over the whole Northeast. Remember, Adi Muhammad hired her to be the directress over the Northeast region, and that meant New York, Boston, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, all of those areas. And then when she left, then she left me over those areas. And I refused to join her after we had the big convention because Imam was not for Scientology. And when I didn't go along with the Scientology, he eventually, I didn't join her in Chicago, he eventually let her go. He did it very delicately. And she went back to Oakland. I mean, she was from Benicia. And then when the husband died, she moved to Burlingame. And she was very good, very brilliant. She did most of the work. Ron just took the credit. But one day I told her, when she mentioned about disoriented, I said, you know, Doc, the black man and woman, when you take the language, the mother tongue, from a people, you change the brainwave. And she said, oh, I wish I had heard that before I wrote the book. I said, yes, because this is why many of us are disoriented. They changed the mother tongue, and we came from so many tribes. And changing that mother tongue to think and act like them, and the other, like Muhammad said, that was the worst language to ever learn, English, I think it had an effect on our brainwave and our thinking and our doing. That was an DNA that just couldn't be destroyed was what saved us. So that's our problem. I think the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Booker T. Washington really was trying to get to the bottom, to the root of the thing, do for self, go in the dust. They were right. And until we get back to that, because we're trying to do what everybody else does. And I like the sister's comment about the Japanese, but they have a whole different culture. Their nomenclature fits the culture. We were just disoriented, period. And Imam made a comment one time and said that we all are schizophrenic, and that is true. And I think the only sane way, we were on our way with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, even if it was a lot of mythology, it was putting us in a certain framework to work from. Now, they have been dumbing down the school. They did it on purpose, and they did it to their own. And when I was at Berkeley, you know, I had to tell the guy that I eventually married, my homework, and Brother Imam Musa, you knew him, Brother Clyde. Now, he came from a father. His dad is a doctor. All of his brothers are doctors, 5 of them. His sister is a doctor. His mama was educated. And like I was telling him, he was having a difficult time. I said, brother, they teach their children at home by the fireside. What we got out here, these people, their daddies and mamas wrote these textbooks, but they give the real meanings by the fireside at the breakfast table, at the dinner table. And I knew that because I think some of you know, I went to an all-girls, all very, very elite white Catholic college after the Civil Rights Movement because they were trying to get me to be theirs. Like you said, the oligarchy. They were working, they planned this stuff. And I was one of their plans. I was to be the first black Secretary of State. And the best way to put it was Allah snatched me. But Dr. Lee died in a nursing home, and she was 92 years old. And we talked up until she no longer recognized me. I was the last person that she did remember because she didn't even recognize her granddaughter anymore. But I think they used her. But she did leave Scientology. And let me say one more thing about that. There's a lot of good in it, but L. Ron Hubbard had to run to keep from being killed, and he took his technology with him. So the technology they're giving at Scientology now, and Doc kept saying that. She'd been a Scientologist for 25 years. She said, that's not the original stuff. So what Farrakhan is teaching even now is something like a watered-down version of what L. Ron Hubbard did. He took the text, and I'll say this and leave it alone. There's a book out. I heard it the other night on a talk show about 2-3 months ago. There's a book out called The Watergate Hoax, and he said, I'm just going to tell you the truth. He said, Nixon didn't send anybody to break in the Watergate. He said that was the CIA that wanted to steal L. Ron Hubbard's technology, the thing about OT out of theta, and now they're using the language OBE, out-of-body experience. And the CIA wanted that so they could teach people to go out of the body, go into Russia and our other enemies, and hear and listen to what they're saying. They got a little thing called remote viewing, but it wasn't as powerful as L. Ron Hubbard's OT out of theta. Now, I'm giving that because that was what Doc was all about, and she was one of the originals, so they had to kind of snatch her up, put her in a home, and make sure she died. And that's what they do, and that's what the oligarchs do. They only want us for them. The dumbing down that Brother Mustafa brought up is on purpose, and that is because most people will be led like cattle back to slavery and back to concentration camps. Everybody's talking about it. It's on all those alternative radio shows, and I began to listen to them about 5 or 6 years ago. And it pretty much lines up to what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was teaching us, if you can connect the dots. Now, what we need to do for our school is do what the Honorable Booker T. Washington and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was trying to tell us, knowledge of self. Start teaching about us and then go back to our real original black history that we put Egypt together, which was Kemet. We built those pyramids. We did this. We had all those cities. Teach on the Mansa Musa, the richest black man in history. Teach on the people that built the pyramids. Teach on the apothecaries that we had. That's why George Washington Carver had the ability, because they didn't go just get savage people. They went to our universities and stole the professors out of Timbuktu, Ghana, Sanghe, Mali. Now, I know this stuff. My first husband was chairman of the African History Department and had done a lot of traveling and ordered a lot of books for his department. And because I helped him with the curriculum, wrote up the curriculum for his classes, I read all those books that in the summer. We need to go back, not just talk about slavery. That's not our history. Our history is all about building every civilization borrowed and stole from us. And we need to talk about that. And that will give them an incentive and make them feel like doing something for self. Everything we've done, and even in education, was all about them and pushing them. That's why they didn't want us to leave. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, go for self, separate. And the Holy Quran teaches that too. Certain birds flock together. And that's not bigotry. It's just good sense. Family means familiarity. And I think, and I noticed the difference. I'm born in the South. I went to Southern segregated schools before I went to integrated school. And I noticed that, and even though I went to a Southern, it was a Catholic school, when I went North and West California, I noticed the children are different, especially the females. They were very insecure. And that was because they sat in the classroom with mostly the Caucasians and other people that made them feel insecure. They were not ready and prepared, not all of them. We weren't that insecure because we had our own, and we felt good among ourselves. Family means familiar. And I told that to when I was over the schools in New York, and I was over the schools in Cincinnati for a while, and I taught in the Muslim schools in San Francisco and Oakland. But I taught in the public schools of San Francisco before I became a Muslim. And I absolutely saw the difference. I saw the Spanish kids when it was predominantly Spanish, and the difference when they got in a different classroom with Caucasians and or other children. Now, I just think, and I noticed that what they did on Saturdays, the Chinese had their own schools on Saturday. I started a Saturday school in New York because we need to have our own. The Arab people did it. The Chinese did it. The Japanese did it. They went to public schools, but their parents got together and made sure they kept their culture and taught them on Saturdays for 2 hours. And I visited some of those schools. So we still haven't learned to love and respect ourselves yet. We still think if we mix up and get better, greater hair and a different color, we're going to be all right. Elijah Muhammad said we're just mutts. Obama calls himself a mutt, and some people didn't like it. But he was trying to tell you something. And I'll shut up.
Wow. That was powerful. Halima Mustafa, that was you're very powerful in your understanding. And wow. So
I tried to get away from Doc. That's what Doc said, and I did everything to get away. She said, I need you. You know, everybody else wanted to know her to move up, and I didn't because, like she said, I was already moving up. And she said, if I can't have you, I'm not going. And Imam Wadi Muhammad made, and John Muhammad made Clarence come out there and get me and take a red eye and get to New York because I really wanted to get back to Berkeley and go to law school, but I couldn't get away from Doc.
I can see why. wow. I'm lost for words. You succinctly put it in perspective, and what's now is that do we have the courage to do it? Do we have the money to do it? Do we have the heart to do it?
I think we're tired. I think we have just been so slaughtered and the lies. You know, like the Revolutionary War. They didn't. How you go beat Britain? And Britain used to have in their books, the sun don't set on our empire, which meant they had conquered the planet Earth. And now you're going to come over here with and the farmers with their little muskets or whatever guns and beat the British Army. They didn't win that Revolutionary War. So what we had to learn was a lot of lies and a lot of disorientation. And it just took us from our rightful selves, including the religion. You know, the Bible itself says, thou shalt not make graven images. Then you put a white Jesus in, a white Mary, and a white. And this black man still looking up for this man to be the white Jesus to come out of the sky and save him. So they hit on the right points, Elijah and Imam. We need to get that, understand that, and love ourselves. And I'm tired. Everybody's tired that got the knowledge. And that was their plan, too, to weigh out the ones that's got good sense or can hear and whatever. They have a diabolical plan for everything. And the other Elijah Muhammad said it. He said, you can't fathom the depth of this evil and that we just walked off our post. And I just went and hid. I was tired. I told Doc, I'm tired.
Well, we're going to get you back in fire, back engaged again because we need you for the last leg race. You're the anchor leg, lady.
I'm 73 years old. I am so tired. And I've been at this since 19 because I was involved in the civil rights movement, going to jail and sitting in and dying in and all. I'm so tired. And I talked to Emil Musa because he can hear me and I hear him. And I like his mind. And I'll just be around to talk and whatever. But I told him I'm not getting married again to anybody. I don't want to be bothered. I'm married 3 times. You know I'm good and tired. So, and they were supposed to be Muslims. Shoot. I am absolutely tired. So I'll be here. You can call me. I'm just not going anywhere.
Well, I think as long as we have access to your mind and the call, we can make do with that. If that's the commitment, I say let's make do with that. And
yes,
I'm gonna say this. Go ahead, sir.
No, I just said yes, sir. And you made.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was noting that conceptually, I came up with a term called modern day achiever. To give a young person a self-esteem building block. As they ask themselves, who am I? They look in a mirror. I'm not this word that you call NIG or this one you call alien Hispanic or whatever. I am a modern-day achiever. That puts a level of confidence in them. And they look in the mirror. I say, you are a modern-day achiever. And that is defined by you as you move to the future. So we have to give him some inspirational things that that work in opposite of the breakdown to tell him that the all these negatives. So
That's right. It
begins with that.
That's right. That's a good idea. Yep.
Yes.
You know, I admire you, and I'll push you, and I'll praise you. But when you, and sometimes, you know, Imam said it. He said, sometimes you can see too much. He said that people think I'm sad. He said, I'm not sad. He said, but, he said, my soul is joyful. He said, but when I look out there and see you, this is what he said. He said, I look at your condition, and then you're just picking up what I'm picking up and receiving. I see the pitiful condition that we are still in, and maybe you pick up my sadness from looking at that, but I myself, I'm happy inside. So I think that's what happens to me. I look around and see these and see us, and I subbed a while when I came home, which put me in all the schools in town. And I was across town here, and I was shocked. You'd be surprised what television did to our children. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us not to watch TV. And when I was teaching in the public schools in San Francisco, there were a couple of faculty members who did not allow their children to watch television. The television was a subliminal, seductive game. This Welcome Back Carter and had the kids acting a fool in class. And when I got back here at Star 7, these kids act just like all the television programs. One of the things I noticed, one day I was sitting at the desk, and one little boy would say something, and everybody laughed. And they would laugh just like that track on those sitcoms, and they all stopped at the same time. These children
wow.
had heard that noise. They had heard that noise from the mother's womb, and they were, and then from childhood all the way up, and they all laughed just like the tracks that they use on the sitcoms. Now,
yes.
One of the assistant principals, I knew her, and I called her. I said, come here, Joyce. I said, listen to these kids when they laugh. And she's retired, and I saw her one day, and she said, you were absolutely right. So they got them programmed. Now, Professor Griff talked about how they were programming our children with the cartoons and what was really going on behind, and that's on YouTube, how behind the cartoons they had all of this violence and sexual substances, such subjects, and I believe that. And our children are pre-programmed. Imam told us, he had us reading the book Subliminal Seduction. And our children are looking at TV but being seduced by whatever is on and behind the screen. So with all
yes.
the mechanisms that they've thrown at us, I do believe now they're in a big, big trouble now. I think something's going to happen because we can't clean up this mess. It's going to happen. Dr. Lee always said that, Dr. Fatima, she was Ann Redmond before that. She got her degrees at Purdue, all three. She went to Purdue. She taught at Purdue for a while and came out to California. But she said they're going to blow this place up. She said they don't want to talk about it, but they're going to blow it up. She said because if it's true, and the Holy Quran say Islam will be victorious, and, you know, the Christians say that God, the devil won the battles, but God is going to win the war. Now, if that's true, it sounds more like, and what we're looking at today, sounds more like Dr. Lee was right. She said they're going to blow it up. So maybe they need to blow up all of this filth and then start anew. Now, what you talk about, modern-day achiever, I think we can do a lot of starting early with the early kids so that any of them survive, they can start from there. But it is just entirely too much mess. The school system's here. I haven't subbed in quite a while. It's a mess. The teachers are crazy. The principals are crazy. I'm sorry. It's insanity. It's insanity. They don't know that they're walking insane people.
Yes, yes. Well, wow.
This is Leela. I'm listening.
I'm through.
can you hear me? Yes.
Okay, I want to go ahead and do a slight wrap up, but I do want to invite our caller from the Augusta, Georgia area, who had spoken earlier, to come back and address the topics that we've just finished talking about. I know you are, or at least I don't anticipate that you are familiar with the lady, the psychologist that they have been discussing, but the general topic of what's happening in America today, you're a teacher, and so I know you have some experience with the topic of what's happening, especially with black children in America today. Would you like to address that for a minute or so before we wrap up? That's the lady from Augusta, Georgia. I believe your area code is 706. Okay, I don't know if you're able to hear me, so I'd like to just do a brief wrap-up and then turn it over to my co-host for the final wrap-up. Topic for next week, and probably for the next 2 weeks, will be the topic, The Miseducation of the Negro, based on a book written by Dr. Carter G. Woodson back in the beginning of the 20th century. And these things that he mentioned are still very accurate and very relevant today. And of course, many of us know that he is the founder of what developed into the African American History Month, or Black History Month, which started off as Negro History Week. And he also founded an association for the study of what he called at that time Negro History and Culture. And it's now been changed to use the updated term African American History and Culture. And we'll be discussing that topic, the miseducation of the Negro. But in my final comments, and I want to thank all of you for participating again this week. And I want to refer to my book for those that are listening, that are online listening. I want to invite you to purchase my book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And the subtitle of the book is A Message That Will Change America. And from this book, I'll quote, and this is actually from the writings or speeches of Booker T. Washington, "No race can be lifted up until its mind is awakened and strengthened." Just one moment and we'll continue. "No race can be lifted up until its mind is awakened and strengthened." And of course, we know from research that we've done, and especially from a book written by Edwin Embry called Brown Americans, that the plan of the masters of the slave society was to destroy our mental capacity, or at least our ability. And one of them even made the bold statement to his colleagues that we have, as far as possible, closed every avenue by which light may enter the slaves' minds. And if we could find a way to do it, we would extinguish any light that is in their minds, and we would claim that it was necessary for our own security to do this. So to reverse that damage, what I would call potential destruction, because it never completely happened. We know that even among the slaves, such as Frederick Douglass, there were some brilliant people that broke through that ignorance barrier that they tried to impose upon us. But Booker T. Washington said that no race can be lifted until its mind is awakened and strengthened. Then he goes on to say, and I'll close out with this, that our knowledge must be harnessed to the real thing, or probably to the things of real life. So in our next discussion, we will talk about how we have been miseducated, so that our knowledge that we've been taught in the schools and colleges especially has been anything but harnessed to the things of real life. And I'll let our co-host go ahead with the final minute so that we have closing. Go ahead, Brother Mustafa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would say The miseducation begins with the imagery. The imagery that is dominant in the society makes others who don't look like that become inferior in their perception of self. So
right.
We have to begin with that, because when we remove that,